This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Aspen. Con artists mostly go after our wallets. Abby Ellen wound up with one who went after her heart. Her fiancé lied to her about having been involved in top-secret counterterror operations. He did eventually land in prison. We'll hear from her shortly, but we also got a lot of your stories, too. Here are two messages you left in our inbox.
Hi, my name is Grace. I live in Melrose in North Central Florida.
My name is Thomas, and I'm from Charlotte, North Carolina.
I was taken advantage by a con artist. I actually lost a house in which I had about $50,000 equity.
I went out briefly with an American Airlines flight attendant who had been fired from her job.
It's a crazy story, but I trusted the wrong person, and she ended up with the deed, and I ended up with the mortgage.
She convinced me into borrowing money to make her car payment, and then basically backed out on paying me back for all the money that was invested.
It was pretty awful, and it took 5 years to get things straightened out.
It was a horrible situation with somebody that was less than scrupulous. Let's leave it at that.
Yeah, Grace Thomas, thank you very much for sharing your stories with us. And we'll get to more of your stories in a moment. Today, we're talking about the psychology of deception. Why do con artists lie? And why do so many of us get tricked? Joining us from NPR in New York is Abby Ellen, a journalist and the author of Duped: Double Lives, False Identities, and the Con Man I Almost Married. Abby, welcome to 1A.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And joining us from Dallas is Chris Hart, a professor of psychology at Texas Woman's University. Professor Hart, glad to have you with us.
Thanks for having me, Joshua.
Abby, let me start with your story. Tell us about this guy. How did you two meet?
We met when I was doing an interview with him for a national newspaper. And he was a doctor in private practice in Beverly Hills, and I needed an expert quote. And so somebody suggested this guy, and I quoted him, and we talked, and that was it. End of story.
What was it about him that attracted you?
You know, at that time, nothing. The story didn't run. And a year later, I called a fact check, and he said that he was going into – he had left his private practice, and he had rejoined the Navy, and he was opening up a private practice for kids in Afghanistan and Iraq to treat kids with cancer. And I said, well, that's something I wanna know about. Keep me posted. And so he did. Every so often, he kept me – he would send snippets of information. And we spoke more and more, but it was very professional. And toward the end of the year, this was like 2009, we started talking a bit more. And by February of 2010, we went out. We met in person. And soon we were involved. He was funny. He was charming. He was trying to make a difference in the world. He was engaging. He was smart. And he thought I was fantastic. So all in all, I thought he was pretty good.
What was the first indication that something might not be quite right with this guy?
He told these stories, none of which were verifiable. For example, he had been a Navy SEAL in the past, and he did these secret missions with the CIA. And he would call me from places, and I'd say, where are you? And he would say, I can't tell you. I'll tell you when there's a secure line. And I thought to myself, this doesn't make sense. You know, I'm a journalist. This doesn't add up. But I would ask him, I would question him, and he would get angry with me for interrogating him, A. And B, nothing was verifiable. So it's very hard to fact check when you can't verify the facts, right? It's not like you can call the CIA Human Resources and say, hey, you have this guy working for you.
What was the last straw for you?
Brussels sprouts. Something verifiable. We went out.
Brussels sprouts?
We got engaged. I moved. He was working at the Pentagon legitimately, and I was going to school at Johns Hopkins to get a master's in international public policy. And so we were living together where? At the Watergate, which I find hilarious still. You know, if you're going to live with somebody and be deceived, where else do you go? We were engaged, and it happened very quickly, but that was okay because I was 42 and my parents had gotten married after 3 months and they're still together 55 years later. But the final straw actually was that I couldn't verify anything. These things didn't add up. These crazy stories, you know, like he met his wife when he rescued her when she was held hostage in Iran and he was held hostage in China. And when I would ask him these questions, where, when, he would say it was a secret mission, you wouldn't have heard about it. We went out to dinner with my parents in November of 2010, and he raved about the Brussels sprouts. They were the best Brussels sprouts he'd ever eaten. And when we left the restaurant, he said, that was one of the worst meals I've ever had in my life. And I thought to myself, wow, if he could lie so convincingly about something so inconsequential, he could lie about anything. And I was out.
When you broke it off, what was that like thereafter? I imagine you went through a period of just kind of beating yourself up for being taken for a ride.
No, because I didn't know I'd been taken for a ride, actually, at that time. I didn't know. So I thought, God, I really have issues. I got more issues than I thought. I thought, I am so suspicious. I am so mistrusting. I am so cynical. God, you know, to be in a... And I would talk about this with my friends. I'd say, these things don't add up. He's just so effusive. I don't buy it. And they would say, you just have to trust. You know, the universe has a message for you, and it's to learn this lesson. And I don't buy that. If the universe is thinking about me, the universe's priorities are out of whack. So I beat myself up for a long time. And then a year and a half later, I got a phone call from NCIS, Naval Criminal Investigative Service. A doctor... who worked for the government, was writing prescriptions for narcotics under many people's names, and I was one of them. Did I know this doctor? Did I have a prescription? And I said, I know him, and no, I do not. It was for Percocet, and I prefer Valium. So I ended up, I made this statement, and he ended up going to jail. And then I kicked into journalist mode.
What do you mean you kicked into journalist mode?
I researched. I called his ex-wife. I called his ex-ex-wife, who I didn't know existed. I called the woman he was engaged to while he was engaged to me. I didn't know she existed. I called people he worked with at the Pentagon who felt terribly duped because he was this, you know, their nice, nerdy doctor whom they trusted. I called people, you know, his friends. I mean, I didn't talk to his kids, but his children were devastated because they worshipped him. He had two kids, and his son, who was 13 at the time, thought his father was just this military war hero. He lied to his kid, too. He lied to everybody.
Now, why report out his story? Why not just say, oh, well, that sucked, and move on with your life?
Because the book is not a memoir, and I just want to say that. It is not a memoir, okay? But it is first person, and I talk about my story, and then I explore. And the reason why I explore it is twofold. A, because I wanted to know why this happens. I wanted to know why we lie, why we trust, why we believe, who we deceive the most. And the answer is ourselves. But also, I told everybody this story, and I got these reactions. Everybody knew somebody who this had happened to. Everybody, or it had happened to themselves. Everybody had a story. That was A. And B, a lot of people thought there was something wrong with me for being duped. They were fascinated by him, but I was the one with the problem. What does it say about you that this happened to you? You know,
well,
and
I was just going to ask you about that in terms of the way you reflect on what happened to you. I mean, as you look back at how you engaged with him, there must have been something that mitigated your concerns long enough for him to become a part of your life, whether it was just that you enjoyed time with him, whether you looked up to him for the work that he did, whether the intimacy was really good. Like, there must have been something that mitigated your doubts.
Yeah. There were a few things. A, I was 42 years old. You know, I had run around the world. I had done what I needed to do, and I felt like it was time to be settled down-ish. But it was settling down with somebody who had the same interests I did, which was to run around the world and tell stories and you know, help people. So that was really appealing. He was all those things I said. He was funny. He was smart. He was charming. All of that. He was good. He was trying so hard to make a difference in the world. And he showed up. Initially, he showed up when he said he would. He did what he was supposed to do. He was very reliable. All of those were appealing. His children knew the stories about him. His brother and aunt. His parents were dead, but everyone knew these stories about him. So I was really beating myself up for being suspicious, and that is really what it was. I was having this dialogue with myself on a regular basis. Are you just cynical and mistrusting? I can't stress that enough. I couldn't trust myself. That's gaslighting. That's what he did, right? He made me question everything about my own perceptions and my own reality. And that was I was fighting with myself to work through that and be with him and be in a relationship. And so I hope that answers the question enough. It was really that. He was a good guy, I thought, and I thought I was the one with the problem.
In retrospect, before I bring in Professor Hart, did you fall in love with him, or did you fall in love with your story of him?
Yeah, and I talk about that too, because I write a lot for the New York Times. And I often have covered the vows column, which is, you know, the stories of couples meeting and how they met. And I just thought, wow, what a great story this is, you know, finally. And so I think there was a part of me that was very interested in the story. I tell stories. I'm a writer. So I was very interested in the story. But I think I was in love with him too. I loved him. I definitely loved him. Was it the mad, passionate, over the moon, crazy, backbreaking, you know, mind numbing love? No, but I don't know that that's the kind of love you should, you know, you shouldn't spend the rest of your life with somebody for whom you feel that way.
We're speaking to Abby Ellen, the author of the book Duped, Double Lives, False Identities, and The Con Man I Almost Married. Sorry to say that so many of you have similar stories of people who kind of weasel their way into your hearts. One of our 1A Text Club members writes, "Through online dating, I nearly got hooked by a suitor from Lagos, Nigeria, who claimed to be an arts dealer from Nebraska. After he asked for money to get his arts crate order shipped with his proof of a very small, pixelated version of Klimt's The Kiss, I knew he was a fraud despite his promises and pleas." Professor Christian Hart, let me bring you in. What's your general reaction to Abby's story?
Well, Joshua, I think sadly Abby's experience is a particularly common one. We certainly see all manner of cons occurring through the world, many of them financial cons, but a very sizable proportion of them are these romantic cons. In fact, the Federal Trade Commission estimated in 2018 that people involved in romantic cons had been swindled out of $143 million. So it's a pervasive problem. Her experience is certainly not a unique one.
Now, you are a psychologist who studies deception. And in your studies, there's this concept called the dark triad. What is the dark triad?
When we examine con men and liars and other people who take advantage of others, we examine their personality. And so the dark triad is a concept about the personality of sort of these devious actors in society. And so, as the name suggests, there's three components to the dark triad personality structure. The first one is narcissism. That is, these individuals tend to be extremely self-centered and have an inflated sense of self-importance. The second component is psychopathy. So when we think of the traditional psychopath, these individuals have a callous disregard for the well-being of others. They tend to have very low empathy and no sense of conscience, so no sense of shame and guilt when they do cause harm to others. And then the third component is Machiavellianism. So these individuals tend to be extremely manipulative, seeing others as pawns to use and trying to achieve their own goals.
So narcissism, some kind of psychopathy, disregard for others, low empathy, no sense of shame, and a Machiavellian tendency. It's kind of interesting, Professor, you describe some of the people who are among the worst scammers that we've encountered. You also describe some of the people who are among the most fascinating characters in pop culture. I mean, we have this weird dual relationship with con artists. Some of y'all remember that movie Catch Me If You Can, where Leonardo DiCaprio played Frank Abagnale, the con artist. Here's a quick clip from that movie where he's on the job at a hospital that he tricked into hiring him, thinking that he was actually a doctor. Listen.
Gentlemen, what seems to be the problem?
Bicycle accident. Fractured tibia about 5 inches below patella.
Dr. Harris.
Yes?
Do you concur?
Concur with what, sir?
With what Dr. Ashland just said. Do you concur?
Well, it was a bicycle accident. The boy told us.
So you concur?
Concur.
I think we should take an x-ray, then stitch him out and put him in a walking cast.
Very good, Dr. Ashland. Very good. Well, you don't seem to have much need for me. Carry on.
Leonardo DiCaprio is Frank Abagnale from the movie Catch Me If You Can, which did very well at the box office, was adapted for Broadway, won the Tony Award for Best Lead Actor in a Musical. So, Professor Hart, we have this kind of interesting dual relationship with con artists.
Oh, absolutely. They're fascinating and fun to watch from the outside. We like to see these stories of con men. It's exciting to see them manipulate the system using their ingenuity and their creativity and their boldness. The story portrayed in Catch Me If You Can is a great example. But we also like watching stories that involve things like prison escapes and, you know, evading pursuit, such as in the movie The Fugitive. So we do have certainly this fascination with them. I think when things go from fun and entertaining to more dark is when we start to recognize the moral problems associated with these scam artists and con men. When we start to see the pain that these individuals are causing to others, I think that's when we start to find them a bit less entertaining. In movies like Catch Me If You Can, oftentimes the pain caused to others is not portrayed in the film. When we start to see people harmed, I think that's when we start to back off.
I know we got to pause in just a second, but Abby, what about you? What do you make of that kind of pop culture relationship we have with con artists?
Look, who do we watch? Walter White, Don Draper, Tony Soprano. Mm-hmm. We're still talking about them. There was Nurse Jackie. I mean, there was all of these people in pop culture. We love these stories. We love these characters. We want to know how they do it. And I think part of it is that we want to separate ourselves from them, right? We would never, they're not us. They're psychopaths. There's something wrong with them. And I don't know that that's always the case. I also think that we like to watch these stories because we never think it'll happen to us. And if you think it can happen to you, think again.
Well, we want to talk about some of the economic fraudsters that we encounter. When we continue with Professor Christian Hart and author Abby Ellen, we'll get to some more of your stories as well. Stay close.
Things that were true, I believe them yet. I've seen a new day beyond the sun.
Support for 1A and the following message come from the Platinum Card from American Express. Conversations and civil debate in our society push us forward and connect us with the rest of the world. With the Platinum Card, earn 5x membership rewards points on flights booked directly with airlines or with American Express Travel. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Don't live life without it. Visit americanexpress.com/exploreplatinum. Terms apply.
This week marks the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall Uprising, a turning point in the movement for LGBTQ rights. So in this week's episode of the StoryCorps podcast from NPR, we'll revisit the very first documentary our founder, Dave Isay, made back in 1989, called Remembering Stonewall. Listen and subscribe now.
Back now to our conversation with author Abby Ellen and Professor Chris Hart. We asked you to share your stories of being conned. Here is what Jean left in our inbox.
I was scammed by one young man, a 26-year-old Nigerian man who posed as an American working on an oil ship in China. I lost more than $15,000. I learned that the romance scam business is a multi-million dollar enterprise, and it extends all over the globe. My scammer had me send money to mules in the U.S., Ghana, Spain, Germany, and the U.K.
Wow. Thank you, Jean. We appreciate you sharing your story. And that's a good way to transition into scams that target our finances rather than our feelings. Joining us from Duke University in Durham, North Carolina, is Edward Ballison, a professor of history and public policy. He is the author of Fraud, An American History from Barnum to Madoff. Professor Ballison, welcome to the program.
Very glad to join the discussion.
First of all, can we get something out of the way? What's up with Nigeria? Why do all these scams seem to be coming out of Nigeria?
Well, partly it's the existence of a method that's worked. And so there's a group of people who've seen that it's worked. And so ideas spread about how you can take advantage of other opportunities. The classic scam that people are referring to is an advance fee scam. So whether it's romance or some other kind of opportunity, there's an attempt to build trust and get people interested in some type of interaction. And as people get strung along, eventually there's a request for some type of payment. And this is a very old kind of scam. In the 19th century, it would have been the Spanish prisoner rather than the Nigerian prince.
You have done some research, of course, on fraudsters and scammers and how they've basically shaped the trajectory of our country. There's one particular scam called the Ladies Deposit Scheme. What is the Ladies Deposit Scheme?
So it's basically a version of a pyramid scheme or a Ponzi scheme. So Sarah Howe started up a savings club, really, you can think of it as, in Boston in 1877. She targeted only unmarried women. So this is a way of building trust. She was an unmarried woman, and so she knew the financial difficulties that they faced. And she offered a savings vehicle that would provide incredible returns with the premise that she had Quaker philanthropists behind her who were going to make good on these wonderful kinds of interest rates. And as is the case with all pyramid schemes, what we now tend to call Ponzi schemes after Charles Ponzi, who ran a similar scheme in the 1920 in Boston, is that you rely on late-coming investors to make good on your promises to early investors. And, well, that can work for a while. In fact, in Sarah Howe's case, partly because she also didn't promise incredibly extravagant interest rates, she was able to make this work for 4 years before it collapsed under its own weight.
It's also kind of common for scammers to target people within their own group, people with whom they either have or can develop some kind of strong affinity. I mean, the con in con artist means confidence, right?
Exactly. And in fact, sociologists, prosecutors now refer to this type of scam as affinity fraud precisely for this reason. It's part of a series of ways that people build trust. I tend to trust people like me. I tend to trust people who have the social cues of success. We tend to place great emotional weight on recent events, say like counterterrorism in the case of Abby's story. And all of these are very useful cognitive shortcuts that help us make our way through the world, but they also make us vulnerable.
With regards to building that kind of affinity, one member of the 1A Text Club writes, "Our CPA gained my trust. She ran our books. This was back in the 70s, but it feels like yesterday. After she nearly emptied our accounts, she closed her office and left in the middle of the night. That was a very painful lesson, but I learned from it." Another Text Club member wrote, "A real estate investor infiltrated my spiritual practice group. He conned me into investing and stole $75,000. This was in 2010, and although I filed complaints with the state, nothing was done." One of the big financial scams of the last few years involved a woman named Elizabeth Holmes, who duped Silicon Valley investors with a startup called Theranos. She amassed more than $1 billion in funding based on an invention that did not exist. Back in 2015, before she was caught, she was featured at a Forbes event called 30 Under 30. Here is a clip of Elizabeth Holmes.
When you have that passion, you will get back up when you get knocked down. And you will get knocked down over and over and over and over again, and you win by getting back up. I've always been a great believer in the concept of the 10,000 hour rule. When you go so deep in something, you can become an expert in it. And when you love it that much, you don't let it go.
That's Elizabeth Holmes of Theranos speaking at a Forbes 30 Under 30 event in 2015. She is now facing federal fraud charges. Professor Hart, it's so interesting that Elizabeth Holmes was this plucky character that honestly a lot of people in Silicon Valley wanted to see succeed. This brilliant young woman who had a biotech startup, a woman in a field that can be very male dominated. And it seems, Professor Hart, that it was that very optimism, that very sense of enthusiasm and pluckiness that made her so effective as a con.
Oh, absolutely. I think a lot of psychological research points out some of these interpersonal variables that make some of these con artists seem particularly believable. One of them is just a sense of liking. We tend to be more easily conned by people who are more likable, and that can be from a personality standpoint or even from something as simple as physical attractiveness. And then also having a sense of authority. She had endorsements from the President of the United States, among others. So she had a lot of authority figures that are widely recognized backing her up, which even increases the believability of her claims.
Abby, does that apply at all to your story in terms of that kind of 100% bulletproof sense of confidence?
Well, what I was going to say about Elizabeth Holmes is that also she's a woman, and we're not expecting women to do these things. And I think women are just as capable of duplicity and deception as men are, and as soon as we see more women in positions of power, we will see more of that as well. But yes, absolutely, I agree with what the professor said.
And Abby, to the point you just made, I feel like, you know, when I was in the Bay Area when Elizabeth Holmes' story kind of broke open, I felt like there was a little bit of quiet sexism, quiet chauvinism when the story broke, because the fact that she was a woman added to the shock, as if, oh my goodness, women are so much more virtuous and honest, and it couldn't possibly have been a female investor. This is someone with $1 billion to play with people who are willing to drop money in a hole that they may never get back. It almost felt sexist to say, oh my God, how could a woman do something like this?
Oh, I don't think it almost feels sexist. I think it is sexist. She we don't expect that from women. It's pink collar crime is what it's called. And I actually have a chapter about it in my book, Little Pink Lies. That's exactly what it is. People, she's not supposed to do that. So people were taking her to task for the way she dressed, right? For wearing her jeans and her turtleneck. Well, Steve Jobs did that all the time. People were, you know, upset with her because of the way she spoke. And so she made her voice deeper. Well, people do that all the time. I don't feel like that's part of the con necessarily. Duping somebody, you know, stealing money and getting people to believe. But, you know, why did these people believe her? Because she was a nice, pretty girl, and girls aren't supposed to do that. She got some pretty impressive people to buy into what she was doing, didn't she? She got Henry Kissinger.
We're talking about The Art of Being Duped with Abby Ellin and Professors Edward Ballison and Christian Hart. We'll have more with them just ahead. Stay close.
Support also comes from CarMax. For more than 25 years, CarMax has made it easy to sell your car. They provide free appraisals and offers on the spot. CarMax will buy your car even if you don't buy theirs. In fact, CarMax has bought more than 8 million vehicles. To learn more and schedule your free appraisal, visit CarMax.com.
Hey, it's Peter Sagal. So you're listening to this NPR podcast because you want to be informed. You want to learn something. But what if you need a little break? Well, then you want to check out Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. It's the show that lets your lizard brain enjoy itself for once. You can be serious again later. Listen to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
Back now to our conversation on those big little lies that let people get scammed. I do want to pivot a little bit, because I want to make sure that we touch on somebody that a number of you have commented on as it relates to people who you perceive as con artists. Here is another message that landed in our inbox.
Hi, this is Rusty from Charlotte, North Carolina. I have been conned myself out of a good bit of money, and I never wanted to tell anybody about it. I feel it would make me look like a fool, and I consider myself to be pretty bright. This brings me to think about the greatest con that's been perpetrated on the American public to date, and that's the election of Donald Trump. His supporters don't want to look like fools either, and I think that's one reason they're so adamant about hanging on.
Rusty, thank you for your comment. I want to get back to the aspect of shame as it relates to being con, but Professor Ballison, what do you make of Rusty's comment, this idea that President Trump has conned the American people?
Well, there's a very common thread in the history of American deception for some victims of denial and just a refusal to break the trust that has become so solid, whether that's with a stock promoter or a romantic partner or in some cases a politician. And, you know, so one dimension of this that you can see, again, historically, is a process of investment reloading. This is the slang term that stock promoters use. So that you take the money from someone and then you do it again. You explain that the company has failed, but it's being reorganized and, you know, you don't want to lose your money. So there's this fear of loss that is a very powerful emotion for all of us. So there are certainly parallels that one can point to throughout the American experience where this kind of thing occurs. The other important, I think, dimension of the story here is one of shame. So for those people who don't go through a process of denial, they really may not want anyone to know. This is a comment from law enforcement from the early 19th century right through to the present day, that so many victims won't come forward.
Professor Hart, could you chime in on that as well, this idea about the president? I feel like a lot of the opponents of the president, who are numerous, would look at his supporters and say, you're victims of a con, you just won't admit it to yourselves yet. But that kind of makes it hard to nail down, right? I mean, it's obvious to see that Abby got duped. Like, that's clear. But with something like the president, in politics, it's much stickier.
It is much stickier. I think one thought to consider is that the confidence that we have in our beliefs, whether they're belief in the integrity of a loved one or belief in the integrity of someone in political office, those beliefs or the confidence that we have in those beliefs are not a measure of the quality of the evidence, but rather the coherence of the story that we've managed to construct in our minds. And so we all have these belief systems about the people in the world around us, and to a certain degree, the beliefs and the stories that we tell ourselves about those individuals are rooted in facts, but to a large degree, they're rooted to the emotions that we feel when we're exposed to those people. So if people make us feel safe, for example, we're going to tend to disregard some factual evidence about their deception and tend to see them as more believable.
And what about, Professor Hart, inside the minds of a con artist? For those who view Donald Trump that way, they can point to his, shall we say, flexible allegiance to the truth. But what do we know about the mentality of how con artists justify their lies?
Well, there's a couple of things I could talk about there. One is that I think a lot of con artists tend to see themselves as not being as dangerous or causing as much distress as they actually are. And I think we all have a certain degree of this moral hypocrisy, where we would see something as being awful and terrible if someone did it to us, but if we do it to them, it seems as maybe a little bit more justifiable. So that's certainly one key element. And then I think some of these con artists tend to view their victims as somehow deserving of being taken advantage of. And that's another way where we can kind of shift and shape our beliefs to fit our behaviors.
I wonder how that...
Yeah.
Oh, go ahead, please.
No, and I was going to say also, it's confirmation bias. And with politics, if you are a Republican, let's say, and your political leanings align with someone like a Donald Trump, you're not going to believe they're lying. That's when the other side is lying for political reasons. We saw this with Clinton in the other way, right? So that's in your mind, you just won't see it. It's funny because I get a lot of the reviews, negative reviews I've gotten from people who read my book is because I talked about Donald Trump and his, as you say, flexibility with the truth. And they were very angry with me for bringing politics into it. I don't know how you could write a book about lying and not mention Donald Trump.
Last quick question, Abby. Yeah. After what's happened, do you trust yourself to love again, to date again, to discern that again?
Well, here's what I tell everybody. You know, if someone's asking you for money, you don't give it, period. End of story. You just don't, no matter who they are. But do I? Yeah, I have a really good gut, actually. I thought something was off with this guy, and I left, and I didn't, you know, I didn't get verification until a year and a half later, but I was right. So, yeah, I actually have a great gut, and mm-hmm. and in all sorts of areas. So I feel pretty good.
Abby Ellen, her book is called Duped, Double Lives, False Identities, and the Con Man I Almost Married. Abby, thanks for sharing your story with us.
Thank you.
Chris Hart, a professor of psychology at Texas Woman's University. Professor Hart, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Duke University history and public policy professor Edward Ballison. His book is called Fraud, An American History from Barnum to Madoff. Thank you, Professor.
It was great to be here.
Our conversation was produced by Avery Kleinman and edited by Miranda Fulmore, with thanks to Aspen Public Radio for hosting us this week. Kimberly Adams from Marketplace will be with you tomorrow and for the Friday News Roundup. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening. This is 1A.